Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests so you can develop your own more informed opinion. With the recent passing of Ross Perot, I thought it would be appropriate to revisit his impact on our political system and the independent movement within the United States. So I reached out to two extremely accomplished friends who happen to have known Mr. Perot quite well. The Honorable David M. Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States and CEO of the United States General Accountability Office, and Russ Burney, a top advisor and spokesperson for Mr. Perot during his historic 1992 presidential campaign and his campaign director in 1996. Dave and Russ, thank you for joining me on Deconstructed.
Well, it's an honor to be on and a pleasure to visit with your listeners.
You know, as millennials have begun to exercise their voting rights, it struck me that the vast majority of them would have little to no exposure to the 92 and 96 presidential campaigns of Ross Perot. And in that regard, they can't possibly know what they missed. So let's start with 1992. Russ, you were a significant member of that campaign team. How did you become involved?
By accident. Most everything happens through unintended consequences. I was actually the executive director of the Democratic Party in New Hampshire early in 1992 when they were having the first in the nation presidential primary. And I became familiar with a lot of the media and the vendors up there. And one of the vendors went on to work for Ross Perot's campaign, doing the software that reports income and expenditures of the campaign to the Federal Election Commission. When Ross got out of the race in July of 1992, one of the reasons was that people were raising and spending money without any regard to the federal law, and they were actually committing crimes. So he set together a team to go around the country and recreate the financial activities of all the volunteers. For instance, in Florida, we found 24 bank accounts with Ross Perot's name on it that the campaign had no knowledge of. And all of that information, income and expenses, had to be put into compliance with the Federal Election Commission. I was there to oversee that project. Within a couple of days, it became apparent I was the only one on staff with political experience, and Ross was getting back into the race, so I became the assistant to everybody on campaign in 1992 and spent 9 years working side by side with Ross after that.
And Dave, you knew Ross Perot as well. What was your relationship with him?
I knew of Ross Perot, obviously, when he ran for president. And I was particularly admiring his approach to that race by using charts and graphs and the 30-minute infomercials and just stating the facts, speaking the truth, talking common sense in plain English, if you will, and really thought highly of him. But the time that I had personal interaction with him actually started in 2007 when I went on 60 Minutes, which was unprecedented for a Comptroller General of the United States to do, to talk about how the nation's finances had spun out of control, trying to draw attention to that. And the first person to call me the next morning after it aired was Ross Perot, who complimented me on that. We continued a dialogue after that on a number of occasions. He underwrote a vast majority of the cost of the $10 million a minute tour that my former not-for-profit, the Comeback America Initiative, did in 2012, which covered 27 states, 10,000 miles. And one of our most prestigious players on that was Russ, who's on this. He was part of that tour as well. And, you know, continue to have some interaction with him, including when he planned to publish his own autobiography, which I hope will get published. The Comeback America Initiative, myself and others, provided support for that book, and the family decided not to publish it back at that time. But I hope it does see the light of day, because he's an extraordinary person who really made a difference, and more people need to know about it.
Russ, would you give us a general overview of how the 92 campaign evolved for those who didn't experience it?
It came about by Ross Perot. Now, folks, you have to understand, and this isn't Washington talk, Ross is about service, not about self. So his offer that if people put him on the ballot in all 50 states he would run was that he would be willing to serve the people of America if they did the legwork to make it possible. But he wasn't about promoting himself. And you see that in the campaign when he did, instead of 30-second attack ads against all of his opponents, he did 30-minute infomercials to educate the public on some very complex issues like the budget. So Ross was on Larry King in February of 1992 and made the commitment that if the people around America put him on the ballot in all 50 states, he would run for president. Well, it was a groundswell of activity in every state, and volunteers just organized themselves and conducted petition drives, which is a very, very difficult thing to accomplish in any state, never mind all states. And by the end of the petition drives, they had Ross on all 50 state ballots. I came along in September, and when he was getting back into the race after a little hiatus there from July to September, and he was on the ballots and about ready to go into the debate. I think clearly Ross Perot won all three debates. He was a breath of fresh air in those debates. And both candidates, Clinton and Bush, would answer a question by saying, "I agree with Mr. Perot, but," and the "but" meaning that he can't win, so vote for me. And ultimately, we see on election day from the exit polling that people coming out of the polls saying they voted for Bush or Clinton were asked, if you thought Perot could win, would you have voted for him? And the analysis of that question, which was never reported by the media that paid for the question, is that if people thought Ross Perot could win in 1992, he would have won the election.
Russ, you said something that I'd like to jump in on, if I can, TJ. You said that Ross was all about service above self. And I couldn't agree more on that. And I don't know whether or not Ross was a Rotarian or not. I mean, I'm a Rotarian, and that's the motto of Rotary. We're here to make a difference for others. And he just epitomizes that, and hopefully will be remembered, among other things, for that.
When Ross was 13 years old, he earned his Eagle Scout badge, and he lived every moment of his life as the consummate Eagle Boy Scout.
Yes.
I couldn't agree more. Russ, you talked about his taking that hiatus starting in July. Prior to that, he actually was polling at 39% versus 31% for Bush and 25% for Clinton. By the time you re-entered and he was getting into the debate mode, he was down to 7-9% and yet ended up with 19%. The reason I bring that up is when you look at his impact, and I agree with you, having witnessed all three debates, he clearly won all three debates. The problem is he was posed as a spoiler. And in the exit polls, they also showed that there was no difference. He polled about 38% of his vote from Clinton, 38% from Bush, and the remainder were from people who are considered moderates and independents. One thing he did do, though, by performing so extraordinarily well in the presidential debates, is he drove the parties to make those debates relatively exclusionary. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, the debates have been exclusionary ever since the Republican and Democratic parties hijacked the debates from the League of Women Voters, which was nonpartisan, and believed that the public was entitled to a vigorous debate of all qualified candidates. The Republicans and Democrats think of this as a huge fundraising opportunity for their for-profit company, the Commission on Presidential Debates, and they don't want interlopers in there. The Commission on Presidential Debates was not going to allow Perot into the 92 debates until George H.W. Bush, insisted that there would be no debate unless Perot was included in all three debates. The debate commission came back and said, well, we'll take a chance on him in one, but not three. And George H.W. Bush said, sorry, I'm not participating in any debates unless Perot's in all three. Well, after the 92 election, the Republicans and Democrats learned their lesson. You don't want to give somebody who's plain speaking and talking to the American public without all the rhetoric from partisan politics included in a debate. So they locked him out of the 1996 debates. And it will be almost impossible to ever have anybody other than Republican and Democrat in the debates held by the fraudulent Commission on Presidential Debates.
TJ, for the record, I'm a party to a suit that is suing the Presidential Election Commission in order to provide more reasonable rules that would allow for a third or potentially further candidate to be able to have access to the presidential debates if they demonstrate broad-based public support. You know, what we have in this country right now is a duopoly. It's the Democratic and Republican parties. They want to keep it simple. You're either for us or you're against us. And I think we have to recognize that the latest statistics that I've seen, 46% of registered voters now are unaffiliated. And that doesn't mean that they don't tend to vote Republican or Democrat, but they don't want to be associated with either one. And we need to recognize that those people need to have a voice. And in many cases, they don't because of closed party primaries and a majority of the state.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about Ross Perot when we come back. Welcome back. Our guests are David M. Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States, and Russ Verney, Ross Perot's top advisor and campaign director. Now, in the 92 and 96 elections, one of the highlights of Perot's policy was fiscal responsibility. And Dave, you and I have both stated on occasion that there no longer is a party of fiscal responsibility in today's political environment. Ross Perot was arguing for a balancing of the federal budget and ending of the outsourcing of jobs. We see one of those happening in today's world, but the other one seems to be forgotten. Was Ross Perot the last major candidate to truly hold such a focus?
He was. And while Ross Perot did not win the presidency, he clearly had a major impact on President Bill Clinton's agenda. In addition to that, many of the things that he campaigned on became critical elements of the Contract for America that Newt Gingrich ended up pushing as Speaker of the House of Representatives. And in fact, in my personal opinion, which has been reinforced by several former Clinton cabinet officials and other members of Congress, Ross Perot was probably the primary force behind causing President Clinton and the Republicans to work together in a way that resulted in surpluses 4 years in a row in 1998, 99, 2000, and 2001. Probably never would have happened. So even though he didn't get elected, he did have an impact. Unfortunately, since 2003, things have really spun out of control. And I think he's probably rolling over in his grave with regard to where we are now, but we can get back to that later.
Russ, Dave brings up a great point, the impact that Ross had on the Clinton administration and on the Republicans in the House and the Senate. How did you view his impact, both in 92 and 96, as being able to redirect them to have to work together and try and focus on service rather than self, if you will?
I think there are many ways of winning. And although Ross Perot didn't win the presidency, he won in many respects the debate over the importance of issues in this country. As Dave mentioned, Alice Rivlin, I had the opportunity to meet her a few years ago, and the first thing she said is, thank you and Ross for making the deficit and the debt public information, and we never would have balanced the budget in the late 90s if it hadn't been for Ross. So there's ways you can win by creating a much more transparent debate about the substance of issues by educating the public. Those 30-minute infomercials that Ross did, and he had charts showing the deficit and the debt, and you would think that nobody would be interested. Well, the tune-outs were minimal. There were more tune-in as the program went on, people with a thirst for 30 minutes worth of information from a guy with an East Texas twang and a lot of folksy statements, and in one of them, he had a voodoo stick that he used as a pointer that somebody had given. It was a stick with a chicken claw on the end of it that he used. He had a great sense of humor. He brought that humor to all of his presentations so that people enjoyed learning from him and understanding the depth of the problem of this deficit spending every year and accumulated debt that we're paying enormous amounts of money in interest on, which doesn't buy a minute of education, a mile of highway, or a soldier to defend the country. If anybody wants to know where the money to support domestic programs is, it's wasted in interest on our national debt every year.
Excellent points, Russ. And you reminded me the voodoo economics, when that term came up. If people aren't familiar with it, they need to look it up on the web. But he had a remarkable ability to take complex economic issues in particular and simplify them. And I thought that's where he really stood out. He had my rapt attention during the infomercials because he did talk with breadth and depth. And to me, that's a way to pay respect to the audience. Today, we have national debt and a debt ceiling that's absurd, and yet we aren't even hearing that discussed. Dave, I know you've done some recent shows on that. Can you put that in perspective as Ross might have done?
Well, one of the things that he did, obviously, was he ended up using these charts and graphs, and he tried to bring it down to terms that people could understand. And I'm pleased to be able to say that I'm probably one of the few individuals that actually one of my prized possessions is one of his autographed charts and graphs that he used in the 1992 campaign that showed the amount of federal debt. And what's shocking about that chart is it's obviously it was accurate with regard to the beginning date, which was 1992, but it was also accurate with regard to the end date, which was 2002, as the amount although the curve of the line was very different than what he expected. He expected to continue to go straight up. And as I mentioned before, it went up significantly. Then we had surpluses. Then it started going up again. Look, he had the ability to talk in lay terms, to also use storytelling, and also to be able to take the big numbers and translate them to something that people could understand, you know, per person, per household, et cetera. And that helps to be able to convey the message better. In addition to that, he also helped to talk about the impact on the country, the impact on the family. Ross Perot, from my standpoint, was one of the greatest family men you could probably ever see. And I still remember how going to his office, how he had bronze statues of all of his grandkids. He understood that we can't just live for today, that we need to prepare for a better tomorrow. He understood that we all have a stewardship responsibility, not just to leave things better off, but better positioned for the future. And, you know, unfortunately, there are very few people like Ross Perot in the world today.
I would agree with that. I think very few people know it. At the age of 25, he dug his father's grave to honor him in Texarkana. He had changed his name. His actual middle name is Ray, was Ray. He changed that in his teen years to honor his father because of the relationship they had. His father's name was Gabriel Ross Perot. He was deeply steeped from a family standpoint. Now, one of the things that he had, we've talked about his colloquialisms and so forth, but one of my favorites when he talked about NAFTA. Russ, you want to share that quote with everybody?
Yeah, if NAFTA passes, you're going to hear a giant sucking sound. The jobs go south, our money goes south. And what NAFTA was designed for was to create an extrajudicial body to oversee foreign investment in Mexico because investors were afraid Mexico would nationalize the industries as they had in the past. Unfortunately, by the time NAFTA got passed, the Pacific Rim was cheaper than Mexico, so NAFTA never gave Mexico all the benefits they wanted. It gave them a lot, but not as much as they thought they were going to get because it went off to the cheaper Pacific Rim to exploit workers who work for pennies an hour. And it's all been about exploitation of labor, the lack of environmental regulations, worker safety, any benefits associated with employment. So it was a giant sucking sound where our money went south to for capital investment to build all these plants to take the jobs from the United States. And unfortunately, in a very sick way, we made American workers train the people in foreign countries who were going to take their jobs from them. That was, I thought, one of the most awful things that happened under NAFTA.
No question about it. And it was just the poignant way he was able to make a comment like that, that clarified for everybody what his position was. Now, ultimately, he had that debate with Al Gore, and the favorability of NAFTA actually shifted in 1996, if I remember correctly. But I think history proved him right. So, gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about Ross Perot when we come back. Welcome back. Our guests are Russ Verney, the original chair of the Reform Party and Ross Perot's campaign director and top advisor, and Dave Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States and now a distinguished professor at the United States Naval Academy. Gentlemen, let's take a look at today's political world from Ross Perot's perspective as well as your own. Russ, what do you think Ross would think of the major parties and their leaders today, knowing that you had a bit of a run-in in the past with a celebrity, former Governor Jesse Ventura, back when you were chairing the Reform Party?
I did. Being a celebrity doesn't mean you're not well-educated and you're not capable of handling government, but it's your motivation and how you perform that really is the telling thing. Now, with Jesse Ventura, he had been the mayor of a large city in Minnesota, so he had the capacity, but it became all about Jesse. He was refereeing wrestling matches and putting out bobblehead dolls, and it was all about Jesse Ventura Incorporated as opposed to Jesse Ventura, the governor. I think with Donald Trump, you're seeing him get involved in politics. It's not with public policy. He's not perhaps the best read policy analyst, but he's certainly shaking up the administration and all of the agencies with changes coming along. He's the disruptor in chief. So you can come from different walks of life and have an impact, but it depends on what your personal goal is to get out of it. If you're looking to benefit, then you'll be a failure. If you're looking to contribute, as say somebody like Ross was, you will benefit everybody. Now, when Ross was at the Naval Academy, where David's going to be teaching soon, Ross wrote the honor code for the Naval Academy, and it's still in effect today. And Ross lived that. So he would never get into a name-calling event with other people, especially not people he disagreed with on public matters. Just is beneath a government leader to do things and treat people that way. You treat them with respect, even if you disagree. You got to disagree without being disagreeable.
And if I can jump in on that, TJ, and Russ makes a very good point about the honor concept, is what it's called, the Naval Academy. And Russ was one of the principal authors of the honor concept. And simply stated, it says, they do not lie, they do not cheat, they do not steal. And he embodied that. Most top quality individuals and institutions have a set of core values that they try to live by. And Ross Perot was clearly one of those individuals.
Dave, in my 2010 book, one of my books, National Platform of Common Sense, I have a chapter entitled A Star is Born, in which I warn of the party's shift from trying to attract leaders to run for office to trying to attract celebrities. Do you feel that they are drifting that direction, perhaps driven by media, that the name recognition has become more important than perhaps the civility of the individuals and their focus on service?
Well, if you are a celebrity and you have significant name recall, you have a real advantage in running for political office. In addition, if you're wealthy and can dedicate, you know, a significant part of your personal fortune to running for office, that gives you a further comparative advantage. And it also depends upon how many people are running. You know, as we look back to the presidential election, there were 16 people running for the Republican nomination. And obviously, President Trump, then Donald Trump, candidate Donald Trump, was one of those 16. He was a national celebrity. He also was willing to use part of his personal wealth, if you will, for the campaign. He had a significant percentage of people that supported him, in part because of his celebrity status, in part because of something that Russ mentioned before. He was an outsider. He was a disruptor. And the truth is, a significant majority of the American people are disgusted with the status quo. And the ratings of Congress are very low right now, maybe all-time lows. The Republicans have gone even further right. The Democrats have gone even further left. And the so-called sensible center is largely unrepresented. And by the way, nothing meaningful is getting done. All right. So the bottom line is that I think Ross would, I'm confident that he was very upset with how things have deteriorated, and they appear to continue to deteriorate until we get some real leadership. And that's what we're missing more than anything else.
I would agree with David that Ross, he was all about results. He was focused like a laser. If he was running the business, he was focused on how does he make his employee the best employee, his customer the best customer, and his investor the best investor. And with government, it's producing results, and nobody's produced anything in probably more than a decade with respect to meaningful results for the public.
Government, great, unfortunately, is about inputs and outputs rather than outcomes. And right now, I mean, let's just talk about what people are talking about today. I was on Neil Cavuto talking about the debt ceiling limit. And they haven't raised the debt ceiling limit, which threatens the possibility of a shutdown, which threatens the possibility of a default. Just a basic responsibility that continues not to be done. And by the way, we talked about the budget before. You know how many times Congress has passed a timely budget and appropriations bills by the beginning of the fiscal years during my lifetime? I'm 67. Four times in 67 years. That's an F minus. The place is broken. It's not future focused. It's not results oriented. That's got to change.
And I think, TJ, that Washington is like a bank. You put the principals in, and all these people go to Washington. They do have principles. They do intend to do good for the public that elects them. The problem is that you then add interest to it while they're there, and the special interests get the results, not the public interest. So principal in, interest out, and we the public lose until there's radical changes in Washington. And that would make Russ tremendously happy to see them start producing results.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I think that people didn't necessarily know about Ross Perot, if the government didn't take action, Ross did. He fought for the Vietnam POWs, for example, when the administration wasn't pushing that forward and trying to maintain contact and bring them home. For goodness sakes, I mean, he organized an attack on Iran, essentially, to free EDS employees who'd been held hostage. if the audience is interested, there's a book called On Wings of Eagles. You need to read that at some point in time, because after the overthrow of the Shah, the EDS employees were taken hostage and the United States government wasn't doing anything about it. So Ross Perot actually organized a jailbreak, if you will, at an international level. This was not a man who stood on the sideline. And we don't
His was a lot more successful than President Jimmy Carter's was, as I recall.
Well, that had a little problem with the helicopter back there, for those of us who remember that. Uh-huh. But he was the person who took action. So that's one of the reasons I'd make the distinction between celebrity status and leadership. It's nice to have that name recognition. It gives you a political advantage. And if you have the money to back it, that makes it even better. But the reality is you need leadership. You need to have the strength to attack the issues. We're seeing some of that today. We have a president whose personality may not align with what Ross may have approved of or that we may have approved of, but one can't deny that he's actually taking action, and he is a disruptor, to use Russ's term. Do you see the situation improving or getting worse?
I see the situation getting much better. If you go back through all of the presidents, George H.W. Bush, when he left, there really wasn't a significant policy change. When Clinton came in, he even raised taxes, which Bush had promised never to do, but did. After Clinton left, George W. Bush came in. There was a continuum of the Clinton policies. After George W. Bush, Barack Obama came in. I think the first original thing he did was cash for clunkers, a continuation of Bush policies. So Trump comes along, and he's disrupting everything. Good, bad, or indifferent, he's going to bring change to Washington. And after the Trump administration leaves in 2 or 4 years, 6 years, they're going to have to go through all of these policies and decide, were they really important to America? And if so, were they really efficient for America?
I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind is, if you're running for office, hopefully you're running for office in order to accomplish certain things, because that's what it's really all about. And there's a fundamental difference between a campaign and governing. And there's no question that President Trump is disruptor in chief. I personally don't like his style, but a number of his policies are things that need to be focused on and that need change, including in the area of immigration, including in the area of deregulation, et cetera. I will say that, unfortunately, he hasn't provided meaningful leadership in the fiscal area, and that nobody has since 2000. And that's something that was central to Ross Perot's public concerns, because as former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, and others have said, arguably the single largest security threat the United States has is not some country or group, it's our own fiscal irresponsibility.
Well said. Gentlemen, in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about you? Dave, why don't you go first?
Well, I've got Facebook, I've got LinkedIn, I've got Twitter. Facebook, I'm under Dave Walker. Twitter, I'm under CT Dave Walker, which will change soon because I left Connecticut. That's a different story. And I have a website, which is deficitranger.com, which has a lot of material on it about fiscal issues in particular that Ross Perot cared about.
And Russ, where can people go to learn more about you?
Well, I'm not as technically capable as many other people, so the best place to find me, you know, when that information superhighway came along, I was stuck in the data driveway. So Facebook is probably the best place to find me, Russell Verney, V-E-R-N-E-Y, on Facebook. There is some on LinkedIn, but most of my postings go to Facebook. If anybody would like to learn more about Ross Perot, there's an awful lot of information that I've shared from other sources on my Facebook page. They can learn about this man was a giant, and he's cast a legacy that will be here to impact not only his state of Texas and this country, but the world for years to come.
Gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. You've given us a unique inside perspective of Ross Perot, a man who probably didn't want to be president, which is exactly why he may have been a very good one. So thank you for joining me on Deconstructed.
Thank you for the opportunity to visit with your listeners.
It's a pleasure, TJ.